Members will call the meeting to order. We do have a quorum. First item of business is I need someone to approve the minutes. So Representative Franzen makes the motion to approve the minutes dated January 27th of 2011. Any discussion? All those in favor say aye.
Aye.
Opposed? Motion carries. Members, today on the agenda, we are going to be discussing the Green Acres bills that we have coming up that we're actually going to be hearing on Thursday now. We did make a few adjustments, a couple changes here. We're going to take testimony and then take up the bills as well. We thought because of some of the concerns that have been raised, we wanted to slow down a little bit and spend some time. Not only do we want to hear from the members that you saw on the agenda to hear the testimony from the legislative auditor, from a few of the farm groups and assessors and a former representative, but I also want to open it up to members here in the crowd. I want to hear from people who have been affected directly. We do have this meeting until noon, so I'm going to do the best I can to keep everybody focused and on message so we can get out of here on time. To the members in the audience, again, I want to open it up and have you be able to come down here and testify. Arlen, can you kind of help direct traffic, if you would, please, when we're doing this? And when we have individuals, if you're interested in coming up and testifying, we'll bring you up. If there's something that has not been said that you feel must be covered, then please, by all means, we want to hear from you. In the event it begins to get, for lack of better words, we start repeating ourselves, then I'll be limiting the testimony if we get to that point, okay? I, of course, ask everybody to be courteous and respectful. I know that this has been, at least as far as the emails and the phone calls that I've received, I know that this can be kind of a hot topic. And so I just, again, just want to remind everybody to be respectful. And I will do my best to keep everybody, like I said, on message and on time. The first testifier, we have Ms. Hauer from the Legislative Auditor. And please, if you'd like to introduce yourself for the record and who you represent, and proceed, please.
Thank you, Mr. Chair and members. My name is Jody Hauer. I'm with the Office of the Legislative Auditor. And what I'm going to do this morning for the first few minutes of your meeting is talk to you about the evaluation that our office released back in early 2008 and the recommendations that it contained. Each of you should have a copy of the slides that I'll be going through this morning. I do want to say that the evaluation is based on how the program existed back in 2007, and so I'm going to be making references to how it was structured back at that point. I know that other changes were made, obviously, in 2009 and even 2010, and I'm not the one to answer those kinds of questions, but I can certainly talk to you about what we found as the program was structured back at that point, 2007. So I'm going to start by giving you just a quick overview of what we found and then get into a bit more detail on what I thought were the most important findings. First and foremost, we found that the Green Acres program is very effective at equalizing taxes for farmland owners. It does a great job of equalizing tax burdens. But at the same time, it doesn't help everyone who could be eligible for the program. It was unclear to us whether the program's goals included benefiting certain owners and certain types of land that were receiving the benefits. The program had some eligibility criteria at the time that were unworkable and also created some inequities. And we found that the program had not been consistently implemented around the state. So those were the big sort of problem areas, or at least questions that we raised. And let me talk a little bit more about what I mean by some of these things. I do want to start with what I consider a very basic primer on the program. I think most of the members of this committee already understand it, so I'm not going to spend a lot of time there. But some of the concepts are important for understanding what we consider to be questionable later. So the Green Acres program applies only to farmland when the value of that land has increased due to non-agricultural factors. So things like development pushing up the price of the value of the land. And to be eligible, the land has to have met certain eligibility requirements. There were ownership requirements. there were size and land use requirements, such as the land had to be classified as agricultural, the land had to be at least 10 acres in size, and it had to be or it had to be a nursery or a greenhouse. So 10 acres in size or a nursery or greenhouse, and it had to be primarily devoted to agricultural use. I'm going to be coming back to this concept in a little bit. There also had been an income requirement that was changed in 2008, and I think it's no longer part of the discussion, so I'm not going to get into any of those details today, unless you have questions about that. So back to what I thought was our major finding, and that is that the program effectively equalizes property taxes. So it does this by significantly reducing the value of the land that's enrolled in the program for tax purposes. Of course, for Green Acres, the land is going to be valued as of its agricultural use. It's not going to be valued as to what the assessor might say is the highest or best use of the land. It's the agricultural use of the land that's going to determine the value. And there's a significant difference between those two. And this, I hope this will illustrate that difference.
And excuse me, Ms. Howard, I just want to let the committee members know that in the binder there is some handouts about the Green Acres and the auditor's summary as well. So, all right. Thank you, Ms. Howard. Please proceed.
Mr. Chair, thank you. So, to illustrate the difference between those two values, I looked at what the average value was for an 80-acre parcel located across the four very fast kind of growing counties just immediately north of the Twin Cities area. And what we saw was for the land in terms of its value, in terms of its highest and best use, it was at $6,500 an acre. But if that land were enrolled in the Green Acres program, that value is actually reduced to $1,900 per acre, a very significant reduction for tax purposes. In fact, that's more than a threefold difference in the value of the land for taxation purposes. So, of course, due to that lower value for agricultural use, that means that the property owners are going to be paying less in property taxes. And what we estimated was, back in 2007, that the program had reduced the amount of taxes paid by those landowners by about $35 million around the state. Now, that $35 million is paid by shifting that tax burden to other nearby landowners who are going to be paying slightly more in their property taxes as a result of the land that's enrolled in the program. Another just basic fact about the program, besides the tax equalization benefits, it also defers special assessments when those are levied for public improvements and the like. And then another provision was that when the landowner in the program was going to sell his or her land, those landowners were required to pay back some of the tax benefit that they had achieved over the years or had acquired over the years. So historically, landowners were required to pay back 3 years' worth of the benefit that they had received in terms of reduced taxes at the point they were going to sell their land. Now, that was changed somewhat back in 2008, bumped up to a 7-year payback, and I believe other changes have occurred since then. But in any event, anything prior to that payback period still represented a permanent tax break for the landowners in the program. Now, as I said, the program is effective at equalizing tax burdens, but we found that equalization had some limits, and I want to talk about those right now. First of all, the program had not been implemented statewide when we looked at this back in 2007. As of that year, there were 35 counties that did not have land enrolled in the program, even though when we talked to their county assessors, they told us that there were non-agricultural factors driving up the value of land, at least in some parts of their county. Now, this particular map shows what the enrollment looked like back at that time. The white areas of the state are those areas where there isn't any land enrolled in the program. The darkest green represents the highest concentration of land enrolled in the program. And again, this is back in 2007. Second, we said that we thought the program's value in terms of effectiveness in equalizing tax burden was limited because there are certain landowners who simply decide against applying. So they might very well be eligible, but they haven't applied for the program. And to get the tax break, one has to apply and be found eligible. People who are about to sell their land or thinking about selling their land might decide not to apply. Some people just have a mistrust for government programs. Assessors gave us a couple of other reasons that they thought that landowners simply hadn't applied. But in any event, there were some unknown number of landowners who potentially could have qualified but had not applied. And then the final point that we thought was relevant is that there were what we thought landowners who probably weren't aware of the program. When we conducted the evaluation, we talked with most of the county assessors who had land enrolled in the program and talked with them about a number of things. But one of the things we asked them was, well, how do they get information out to the landowners in their county about the program? And we found that of the 48 counties we spoke with, there were five who had some land that could have qualified, but they didn't provide information to the landowner unless the landowner requested it. And most of the other counties that we spoke with, the county assessor actively, kind of proactively, would send information about the program out to the landowners who were potentially eligible. And so we thought there was at least a potential there for some landowners who could be eligible but were not aware of the program.
Excuse me, Ms. Hauer. We have a question. Representative Hansen.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. And Ms. Hauer, you've gone through a few slides here about program requirements and problems and effectiveness, but what is the purpose of Green Acres? Is it a tax reduction program for some landowners, or is it an ag land protection program to prevent farmland from being developed? What is the purpose of the Green Acres program?
Ms. Hauer.
Mr. Chair and Representative, well, the tax equalization purpose of the program is in statute, and that is clear. There is, I think, a common understanding that the program also is intended to preserve farmland, and I am going to talk about that in just a moment here, but actually statutes don't specify that as one of the purposes of the program. So I am going to talk about that, and we did come to some conclusions about whether we thought it was effective as a land farmland preservation program.
Representative Hansen.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. And a follow-up, so tax equalization, so when some landowners' taxes go down within the taxing jurisdiction, other landowners' taxes go up. Is that correct?
Sauer.
Mr. Chair and Representative, that is true. The burden of taxes that is presented as relief to the farmers who are enrolled in the program gets shifted to other property owners who aren't enrolled in the program.
Representative Hansen.
Mr. Chair, so this is a tax redistribution program where the liability for taxes is redistributed within the taxing entity.
Sauer.
Mr. Chair and Representative, it does redistribute the tax burden.
Representative Hansen, please proceed.
Thank you. So I'm going to move on to the next slide, which has to do with what were some of the controversies over who received the Green Acres benefits. And we found four types of cases where it was legal for that land to be in the program. The land qualified as far as how statutes read at the time. But we concluded it was unclear whether the program's goals had it intended to include them. And so we wanted to bring them to the attention of the legislature and have them make some decisions about whether or not it was still appropriate for these types of land to be receiving the benefits of the program. And I'm going to go into a brief description of those four instances. So for instance, landowners who were not farmers could receive the benefits of the Green Acres program. They would own land classified as agricultural land. They might be land investors. They might have held it for the required number of years, but they weren't themselves farmers. They weren't themselves in agricultural production. The second area was for landowners who could benefit when only a small proportion of the land that they owned was actually in agricultural production. For example, we thought it was questionable if you have like an 80-acre parcel, 15 acres in agricultural production, but the remaining 65 acres in woodlands or perhaps near shoreland or in some other way not in active agricultural production. And we thought that there was some unfairness there because that land was getting a tax break because it was enrolled in the program, whereas a similar piece of property that had an attached 65 acres of woodland or near a shoreland, but it wasn't assessed as agricultural land, wasn't getting that same kind of a benefit. A third type of what we thought was somewhat questionable about the eligibility had to do with land where the values had increased, but not due to development pressures, instead due to recreational pursuits like hunting, using the land as a hunting preserve, and that had driven up the land value. Then the final area was small farms. Farms that had 10 to 12 acres or so, and it was in some cases questionable as to whether they were primarily devoted to agricultural use. Now, I want to make clear again that all these four instances were legal at the time we were examining the program, but we thought it was important for the legislature to take a look again at these four kinds of instances because, first of all, the benefits of the program are sizable, $35 million tax reduction around the state. And then secondly, as it's already been pointed out, the tax relief that was provided to those enrolled came from higher taxes paid by the surrounding property owners.
Excuse me, Ms. Hauer, we have a question from Representative Eakin.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. And I was wondering, you talked about those that were non-farmers, landowners who were not farmers. And I was wondering if you could tell us, you know, what proportion of those that are participating are non-farmers and how you determine whether they're a farmer or not. That can be a little difficult, too, I would assume. Are you talking about people who primarily make their living off of farming, or do hobby farms also qualify as farmers in your definition?
Ms. Hauer.
Mr. Chair and Representative, we don't have numbers on how many people who were in the program were actually farming. That was based on our discussions, our interviews with the county assessors around the state. They would tell us about instances where the landowner was a land developer, not a farmer. And the land developer met all the other criteria because the developer probably rented the land to a farmer who was working the soil or using it for pasture or whatever the case might be. So the developer wasn't breaching the law, but it was a question that we thought should be posed to legislators. Is that appropriate?
Representative Eakin, follow up.
Well, thank you, Mr. Chair. And any idea, did it sound like it was quite prevalent, though, or that this was quite common, that there were, for instance, developers who were qualifying for the Green Acres?
Ms. Hauer.
Mr. Chair, Representative, of course, common is a relative term. In some counties, I would say that they were common, but certainly I wouldn't say it was common statewide. It really varied by the county and the type of land and whether there were pressures for development.
Representative Eakin? Sorry. Representative Vogel, you have a question? Representative Anderson?
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Ms. Hauer, you mentioned small farms, and I'm just wondering in your investigation, was there a definitive or definition of farm, not small, not big, not large, just farm? What was the definition that you came across? You said a small farm had a legal position in this law, but you're questioning small farms as not being credible to their viability as far as 12 acres, 15 acres, or whatever the case might be.
Sauer.
Mr. Chairman, Representative, we didn't come up with our own definition. We were relying on the statutory definition, of course, for agricultural property. And I think what the question involved here was, with a small farm, assessors faced the question of if it has 12 chickens on the farm, does that qualify it as a farm, even though most of the acreage isn't going to be used for agricultural production? So I think that's where the question came in. It wasn't so much as whether we thought that a 10 or a 12 acre or 15 acre farm was appropriate. It was the use of that small farm and whether that was sufficient agricultural use to qualify for what was primarily agricultural. And that's what the statutory definition was, primarily agricultural.
Follow up, Representative Anderson.
Ms. Hauer, could you tell me how long Green Acres, the Green Acres statute had been in law?
Ms. Hauer.
Mr. Chair and Representative, decades. I mean, it was back in the, I'm sorry, I can't remember the exact date, but it's been decades. Thank you.
So, Ms. Hauer,
Representative Anderson,
the last 20 years, 40 years, whatever it is, the definition of a farm has been determined by the local county assessor as to what they determined was a farm?
Mr. Chair and Representative, of course, the statutes are there to help define it, but they don't have the kind of specificity that would allow an assessor to make a black or white decision. Yes, this is. No, it isn't. And what I'm going to talk about in a moment in one of these slides is some of the inconsistency we found when we went from county to county, where in some counties what one assessor would say qualifies and another county did not. So that's, I think, where the difficulty came in, was just the level of specificity that was lacking from the statute to help make that judgment.
Yeah. So, Ms. Hauer.
Representative Anderson.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Ms. Hauer, so now you feel the state needs to step in and take over the position of local assessor and county assessor as far as determining what that definition of a farm is throughout the state rather than letting the local control be in place.
Mr. Chair and
Representative. Ms. Hauer?
No, I think what we found from talking with the assessors was that there was some interest in having some more definition that would help them make a judgment. We also thought it was important to have additional consistency where it was lacking at the time. And without that kind of specificity in the statutes, the kind of inconsistency we saw, which I'll talk about in a moment, would continue. So I don't think there's always going to be some judgment involved in the assessor's job. That's not going to go away. But to the extent some of it can be clarified by specificity in the statutes, we thought that was appropriate.
So, Representative Anderson, I believe the year was 1967 that the bill was the Agriculture Property Tax Law, a.k.a. Green Acres, 1967. So, do you have any follow-ups there? We have Representative Morrow.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Mr. Chair, that the law you just referenced is 273.111, which cross-references 500.24, which defines farm. I thought I would just give us all the definition of farm, and then I have a question for the testifier. But farming means the production of, number one, agricultural products, number two, livestock or livestock products, number three, milk or milk products, number four, fruit or other horticultural products. So there are four categories, again, ag products, livestock, livestock products, milk, milk products, fruit, horticultural products. Mr. Chair, if I might ask to testify a question, my recollection is that a question, at least in my district, has been about the raising of horses and whether the raising of horses would qualify as farming under Green Acres. I don't recall where that discussion was left off. I was wondering if maybe the testifier could tell us whether those raising horses were landowners who were not farmers or are farmers.
Ms. Hauer.
Mr. Chair and Representative, I know that that was a discussion at the time and probably continues to be. I'm not sure because I haven't been keeping up with the program in the last 2 years since this evaluation was released. But I know at the time that there was a specific exclusion for people who were raising horses, that unless there was something that was in connection with that, like they were also raising hay that was then sold on the market or sold to somebody else. But I'm not the expert in terms of the issue on the horses, and I think it's best to talk to someone in the Department of Revenue who could clarify that for you.
Representative Morrow.
Well, thank you, Mr. Chair. Mr. Chair, you and I are both on the committee, I believe, last year when we voted on whether horses would be defined as livestock, and at least my recollection was it was an open question as to whether that would affect the Green Acres or not. Maybe a future testifier can help clarify that legal question for us.
Thank you. We have Representative Hansen.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, and I have a question on the slide that you have up right now where it talks about non-participants pay higher property taxes. Does that mean commercial industrial property tax owner taxpayers? Does that mean individual? Does it mean the 85-year-old grandma on fixed income in a small town is going to pay higher property taxes? Are they the non-participants?
Sauer.
Mr. Chair, Representative, yes to all. It's anyone who is not enrolled in the program but is in the same taxing jurisdiction of those who are enrolled. So if the people who you just described did not have property enrolled in the program, then their tax burden would be some amount higher as a result of those who are getting the tax reduction.
Representative Hansen.
And Mr. Chair, Ms. Howard, the program is a voluntary program. No one is forced into Green Acres. Is that correct?
Ms. Howard.
Mr. Chair, Representative, that's correct. The person has to apply to be involved, to be enrolled.
Representative Hansen.
And Mr. Chair, Ms. Howard, but the non-participants cannot opt out. Is that correct? That they will all pay higher property taxes depending on the rate of enrollment of people getting the tax break in their tax jurisdiction.
Ms. Howard.
Mr. Chair, Representative, yes.
Representative Paul Anderson.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. Ms. Howard, I'm wondering if the original statute specifically mentioned that this increased land value pressure had to come from development, because one of your bullet points there mentions hunting as a possible reason that is a bit suspect. Does it have to come from development, or why the bullet there on hunting is being a suspect reason for increased land values?
Ms. Hauer.
Mr. Chair and Representative, I think that the question came up because there was so much pressure in certain counties that was driving up the value of the land because of these other kinds of pursuits, like hunting, or like a hunting preserve was the example that was most often given. That wasn't illegal, so no. As I said earlier, that didn't mean that the land was being improperly enrolled in the program. It just was a question that some people thought that the program was supposed to preserve the land for agricultural purposes. And if the land was instead not being used for agricultural purposes, and the price of the land was being driven up by things that, like the hunting or the other recreational uses for the land, some of the nearby landowners thought that that was unfair.
Representative Anderson?
Thanks, Mr. Chairman. Well, just a follow-up, but you could have a farm that was a real farm, but being surrounded by hunting land that would, in fact, drive up the value of that farmland value as well, correct? Ms. Hauer?
Mr. Chair and Representative, yes, that's correct.
Representative Anderson? Mm-hmm. Please proceed.
Thank you. So I'll move on to what else we saw as problems with the program. I won't spend quite as much time here, but there were certain criteria that were, first of all, difficult to implement, but secondly, and probably more importantly, created some inequities that we thought were important to point out. So there were a number of problems with that income criterion. As I said earlier, I'm not going to talk about those since I don't think they're relevant anymore. But there was a problem that arose over how assessors were classifying the land as agricultural, and this has already come up in part of your questions. But the statutes on the classification of property, as one representative just said, told us that there were certain types of agricultural products that would qualify that land to be assessed as agricultural. Some grains in one area, or bees in apiary was another area that that was in statute at the time. But the statutes didn't specify, how much is sufficient, how much of the land has to be used for those purposes. So it wasn't clear, as we talked with assessors, how much land had to be used by, and how many beehives had to be on that land in order to be sufficient to qualify for the program. And we saw that there were variations as we talked with assessors from county to county in how that conclusion was reached. Then there was a similar problem, with the statutory language that required the Green Acres land to be primarily devoted to agricultural use. Again, I think it was that lack of specificity about what is primary use that caused the problem. And so interpreting it could be subjective, and as was already brought out by, I think, Representative Anderson, that assessors are going to have some subjective judgment here, and that's not going to go away. But we thought that there was enough inconsistency from county to county that additional specificity would have been helpful. We found that to talk more about the variation from county to county, I mentioned the verification of the income. I won't go into any more detail there. There was variation in how assessors defined land as primarily agricultural. They treated parcels that had multiple owners in different ways. In about half of the counties, assessors might classify one part of a parcel as agricultural and another part of the parcel as residential. But in some of those counties that did that, where they had those kind of split classifications, the part that was classified as agricultural could be enrolled in the Green Acres program. But in others of the counties that had these splits, they did not allow that to be enrolled. So we thought that kind of inconsistency was unfair. And then the final area that we identified was how landowners are informed about the program itself, and that varied from county to county. So I do want to mention, and I believe Representative Hansen brought up this point earlier, about besides tax equalization, which I think is clearly a part of the purpose of the program, we also looked at the program's effect on the preservation of farmland. And I mentioned already that statutes do not specifically list farmland preservation as one of the purposes of the program, but it's just commonly, I think, it's a widely held position. And so we wanted to look at that even though it wasn't explicitly a part of the statutes. Now, what we concluded is that in terms of its effectiveness, that it doesn't effectively preserve farmland for a number of reasons, and I'll specify those here. First of all, the program does not require any long-term commitment on the part of the landowner to keep the land as agricultural. We looked at some of the farmland preservation programs elsewhere in the country, and that was a component of those programs. Nor is it restricted to the regions of the state that are zoned for long-term agricultural use. So Green Acres, for instance, doesn't prevent a landowner from dividing or selling that land in any way that he or she is interested, and at any time. We also saw that the amount of the tax benefit could be small when you compared it with the rapid rise in the farmland values over time. And I just wanted to give one example here. And again, I'm going to focus on those four counties north of the seven-county metropolitan area. So Isanti, Chisago, Sherburne, and Wright counties. And in those four counties, we have the same information for the other parts of the state in our report, but I focus on these four here. We looked at an 80-acre farm and looked at what the value was and how it had increased over time. And what we saw was that back in 1993, that 80-acre farm had an average of $62,000 worth of value. And that by 2007, that $62,000 had increased to over $520,000. Obviously, a huge increase in the value of that farmland. And obviously, farmland has increased in value in other parts of the state, but certainly not at the same rate. My point here is that the tax benefit that was received by that average 80-acre farm in those four counties was about $1,300 in 2007. That, you know, that's sizable if you look at that in terms of tax bill, but if you look at that in terms of, or in comparison with the value increase, it wasn't as sizable.
Excuse me, Ms. Hauer. Representative Ward.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. The tax benefit is relatively small to increase land values. That spurred a question in my mind about do some parcels get a I know that there's conservation programs like RIM and CPR. CRP. Yeah. CRP. No. CPR. Oh yeah, that's okay. Anyhow, do some parcels get both green acres and conservation?
Mr. Chair and Representative, I can answer that partially, but again, please have somebody from the Department or Health Research to verify how it stands today. Back in 2008, one of the changes made was to remove from eligibility land that wasn't a conservation reserve program. But I know that has, so at the time, yes, when we were taking a look at when we did our valuation, but one of the changes made in 2008 was to remove any CRP land or RIM land from the program. But I know that that has changed since that time, and I just don't have the details on it to tell you how it stands today.
Representative Ward, we can, okay, all right. Spend about 3 to 4 more minutes.
Okay, I'll finish up. So the last point I wanted to make about the preservation aspect, land preservation aspect of this is that the program isn't targeted to land that is, for instance, highly valuable as farmland. It's not the high-quality farmland. It's any farmland that qualifies under the program, or land that's at risk of soon being developed. I mean, if the program were to be really seen as a good mechanism for preserving farmland, there might be some targeting that would focus it on that land that is most at risk of being developed. All right, the last slide that I have here is just to talk a little bit about some of the recommendations we made in our evaluation and what happened in 2008. Because some of what we recommended was considered and things were enacted, but in other cases, they weren't enacted. And what we had said is that the legislature should clarify in statute what types of land legislators thought should be eligible for the benefits of the program. And the legislature did this in part. It did remove the eligibility. Well, first of all, it created the new Class 2B land, the rural land, the rural vacant land, and it said then that land would not be eligible for the program. And it also said that the land in the conservation reserve programs would no longer be eligible. We also said that the legislature should eliminate that income criterion, but at the same time it needs to add to the statutory definition some more specificity. And we're talking specifically about how land is classified as agricultural, as well as that phrase primarily devoted to agricultural use. We thought more specificity there would be helpful. The first part of that recommendation was done, that is, the income criterion was eliminated, but that specificity that we've already talked about earlier was not added. We recommended that the Department of Revenue continue some efforts that had already begun to improve the consistency of the state of the program around the state. And the legislature back in 2008 did include in its changes a recommendation that the program be have statewide implementation by tax year 2011. So the last thing I will point out, Mr. Chair and members, is that there were several things that were changed in 2008 that really didn't come from our report. I'm sure it came about as part of the discussions, perhaps, that emanated from our report. But our report, for instance, didn't address that payback period. I know that in 2008, one of the changes was to change it from a 3-year payback to a 7-year payback. we did not make that recommendation. We didn't even address that. We just thought that that didn't need to change. So with that, Mr. Chair, I will conclude my remarks. I can answer other questions. Thank you.
Thank you. Representative Torkelson.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Ms. Hauer, we've talked a bit this morning about the fact that this program has the effect of potentially raising taxes of people who don't participate. To your knowledge, are there other programs within the property tax system that have a similar impact, where we give relief to one particular class, which increases the burden on another class of property?
Ms. Hauer.
Mr. Chair and Representative, of course. I mean, the classification system itself does that, as you well know. The rate for certain classes will be higher than it is for others, based on the judgment of the legislature as to how much value should be taxed for a certain type of property. The rate for commercial industrial property is higher than it is for residential, higher than it is for agricultural. So of course, yes.
Representative Torkelson. All right. Seeing no other. Pardon me? Oh, Representative Hansen, I'm sorry.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I want to go back to kind of the, Ms. Hauer, the public purpose discussion, because you mentioned, I mean, and to follow up on Representative Torkelson's comment, that we provide value to certain things, we tax at different rates, but there's generally an implied public purpose or a public discussion about that. And so if the public purpose is perceived as protecting farmland from getting made into a strip mall, or being paved over or being built on, I think you said that that perceived public purpose isn't being achieved, that there's no evidence that that is occurring, that the tax breaks are occurring without the solution or the outcome of that public purpose achieving that goal. Essentially, we're providing tax breaks for people, but the responsibility of maintaining that land as agriculture, there's no responsibility required. The landowner can choose to sell it at a moment's notice and get out of the property back at 2008. Is that correct?
Ms. Hauer.
Mr. Chair, Representative, it's true, of course, that's true, Representative Hansen. The payback period, of course, would apply, so there still would be some requirement that the owner, once that owner sells, to pay back the benefit that had been accrued over the previous 3 years. But other than that, you're right, that at any point, a landowner could make that decision to sell the land, and it could be purchased for development or whatever purpose was being contemplated.
Representative Hansen? Okay. So, Representative Hosh.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. And just to touch bases on the public purpose, too, I want to bring some context to this, especially in central Minnesota when we're a dairy economy. Milk prices have plummeted. Homestead prices have plummeted and have been transferred onto agriculture properties. The market value credit is eliminated. It's been a perfect storm for our egg producers when it comes to the pressures on their costs. And I think part of the public purpose is to make sure that our farmers can weather this perfect storm. And Green Acres is that also. So maybe we need to refine the public purpose and statute, but it is also in the eye of the beholder. And my folks believe that not only is it to preserve farmland, but it's to make sure that the environment in which they operate in is at least fair enough or allows them to get through some of the difficult times. And it's a very difficult time in central Minnesota. Everything has compounded on top of each other. So I'm glad we're having this discussion, and I hope that we have a solution.
Thank you, Representative Hosh, for your comments. Okay. I'm going to ask a member from Revenue to come down, and we do have a question, Representative Ward. While you're making your way down here, members, I would like to recognize the 9th and 10th grade students from Great Rivers School in St. Paul. They are participating in the Minnesota Historical Society's Capital Historical Sites Voice of the People. So welcome, everybody, to the Ag Committee. So I hope you enjoy. So please state your name and who you represent for the record, and we have a question from Representative Ward, please.
Mr. Chair, members of the committee, my name is John Hagan. I'm the Director of the Property Tax Division with the Minnesota Department of Revenue.
Representative Ward, would you like to ask your question once again? As far as the dual role.
The CPR one or the CRP one?
Well, it may need a little revival here, so either one.
Well, Mike, if you reference that question, Mr. Chair, my question was simply that, you know, are the Green Acres recipients also able to receive conservation program reimbursements like RIM and CRP?
Mr. Chair, Representative Ward, the answer is, like most things in property tax, sometimes. CRP, RIM, those lands that are in a temporary easement, if they're involved in a temporary enrollment, they are eligible for the Green Acres enrollment and the Green Acres benefit. If they're in a perpetual, CRP or RIM that's in a perpetual agreement, then they are not eligible. And I believe the rationale was that once it's in a perpetual agreement, the potential to ever farm the property is gone. Consequently, the land value would be reduced somewhat to reflect the inability to ever develop the land, so it's already getting a benefit from the perpetual easement. If it's a temporary easement, it is entitled to the Green Acres protection.
Right. Representative Ward? Okay. All right. Thank you very much. Members, what I'd like to do is, for time management purposes here, is we're going to switch up the order of testifiers. We do have some people that are here to testify that spend a lot of time at the Capitol, and so we're going to move you to the end, all right? And what we'd like to do now is hear from the people. I am going to call Mr. and hopefully I get your names correct, all right? First on the list is Mr. Don, is it Stanky? So please, if you'd make your way up here, and I guess on deck would be Mr. John Kazemius, I believe. So please state your name for the record and proceed. And again, we're trying to best manage our time here as well. So with that, please okay. Begin.
Well, I'll try to help best manage your time.
our time. Thank you.
Yeah. My name is Don Steinke, and I'd like to thank you for the opportunity to speak before your committee today on the ongoing Green Acres saga. My wife and I farm about 800 acres near Forest Lake. We raise corn, soybeans, hay, and we feed beef steers. This is an issue that's very important to us and the 16 landlords that we rent from. Prior to 2008, Green Acres was pretty much a routine issue that we dealt with every year. It was something that was working very well for us and our landlords who were in the program. Then someone in this great hall decided that the program was broke and needed to be fixed. There may have been areas in the state where the program was not being administered properly by some county officials, but that did not justify, in my mind, changing the whole program. A tightening up of the administrative process would have solved most of these problems. On January 29, 2009, 2 years ago, I testified before the Senate Agriculture and Veterans Policy Committee requesting that they repeal the changes made to the 2008 session and restore the Green Acres statute to pre-2008. That didn't work, but I am glad to see that now there are three bills proposing to do just that. And I would like to thank the authors of these bills for coming around to that idea. The Class 2B Rural Preserve Property Tax Program, in my mind, is a very poor way to deal with non-tillable ag land. The last thing that we need is another government program with a totally different set of guidelines for participation. Every farm in the state has areas that are not tillable, but they're still part of the farm. To split them out into another class and force producers to enroll them in another program with more administrative paperwork and costs is not realistic or practical. These areas are still part of the farm and need to be included in the Green Acres program as they have been for the last 40 years. There are areas of the law that probably could use some tweaking. One of these areas that I'm particularly familiar with is the taxing of billboards and cell phone towers. Living in the metro area, we're in Anoka County, along freeways and in certain other areas gives ag producers the opportunity to earn some supplemental income from leasing small areas of their land to these two businesses. In February of 1999, we signed a lease for a 15-foot road easement along the west property line, which included a 50 by 75 foot area next to the road to put a billboard sign post in. this parcel is adjacent to Interstate 35. It is a 20 acres of tillable land that has been enrolled in Green Acres since we bought it in 1982. It continues to be farmed today as it was when we bought it. When the proposed tax bill for 2011 arrived, our property tax classification had been changed and the taxes were increased 1,051.1%. A call to the assessor was met with the explanation that we are now taxing the billboards. Apparently, Washington County developed a theory, legal or not, that they could tax billboards and cell phone towers, so Anoka County is implementing the same procedure. A friend of ours has a cell phone tower on his land with a similar lease agreement to ours in Washington, and Washington County has now started taxing him for the cell tower. We file a Schedule E for the income from the billboard lease land and pay federal and state taxes every year on that income. I feel that land that is enrolled in Green Acres and has had no changes in use or changes in service requirements, such as police, fire, or school areas, should not be subject to this kind of extraordinary tax hike. The Green Acres law allows for special assessments for services to be deferred as long as the land continues to be used for ag purposes. I feel that this should also apply to this type of situation. Green Acres is designed to protect land from exorbitant costs resulting from it being located in an urban area. This is just one area that maybe needs to be looked at. There may be others, but going back to the pre-2008 status is a very positive beginning. I would encourage your support for House File 12, 142, and 148. I'd like to thank you for your time.
Right. Members, do we have any questions for the test? Representative Eakin.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, and I forget the name again, Mr.
Stanky.
Okay, Stanky, yeah. Mr. Stanky, yeah. Thank you. I was just wondering if you're still in the Green Acres program or if any acreage was lost as a result of the reforms that were implemented in 08 and 09?
I'll get this right.
That's okay.
We are still in the program. So far, our landlords are. The Rural Preserve Program has some of my landlords that have land that is not farmland have taken it out of and not elected to go into the Rural Preserve Program. So those areas have been lost. But as far as the tillable land, no, we have not lost any yet.
Okay. Thank you, Mr. Stanky.
Any other questions for the testifier? Mr. Stanky, thank you for your testimony. Appreciate it. Mr. Kazemius, and following the testifier, Mr. Ronald Lindquist. So please state your name for the record and begin.
Hi, I'm John Kazemius. I live in Farmington in Dakota County. We're down by Meesville, Minnesota. Have you ever heard of Meesville, the home of the Mud Hens? Anyway, I've been in the Green Acres and the Ag Reserve since the very start. When the Green Acres started first and the Ag Reserve came about 8 years later, they tried to improve the Green Acres law. I just like to tell you the good things about the Green Acres law and the bad things about it. Is that the good things about it is that we have to save our good, high productive farmland. I mean, why should we give a tax break for land that doesn't produce anything? Why should we shift the taxes? I mean, and we have to have a longer commitment than just 8 years. I mean, we have land in Dakota County that maybe I should just tell you, you probably won't believe this, but I got a can of peas here. We can produce 5,000 cans of peas. We plant them in April, harvest them in June. Sells for right now $1.29 in the grocery store. Sometimes it all depends on the crop. Sometimes they sell for $2, and sometimes they sell for under that. But that 5,000 cans of save and a buck and a half is $7,500 an acre. Then we can go, we harvest them in June, then we go and we plant sweet corn for Green Giant. And we get 5,000 cans of that. That's another $7,500 an acre. That's $15,000 an acre, what the consumer pays for this in the grocery store. The farmer gets about 6 cents a can for it. But that's jobs and income for everybody in Minnesota. So, but we're pouring concrete on this land. We got to do something. We can't have
We have our zoning out there at one house for every 40 acres. You can't farm with machinery today. You go out there with 70, 80-foot machinery and farm around houses. You can't do it efficiently. So we got to change this. We got to farm back. We got to, because I've had two of my neighbors that went on, that quit, had to quit farming because financially last year. Even though our prices are good, corn is $6, but fertilizer is out of this world. John Deere tractors are out of this world, so it's still a squeeze. I mean, I'm not here complaining because I have four of my children are farming, and I want to, and they enjoy what they're doing. But right now, I have a tax statement here that we're paying $39 an acre in property taxes on an acre farm. I mean, an acre of farmland doesn't demand anything in services. In 1998, the legislature appointed to have a study made. I have a copy of it here. Yeah, it was to figure out what it costs to have the extra to have a family build a home in the country or have it built in town. And it was about $500 per person, per resident. I think if you check with the Department of Agriculture, that you'll find the figures on the total figures on that. That was 1998. The energy costs a lot higher. I live 14 miles from school, and there's three Hastings school buses go by my place before 8 o'clock every morning. That costs money, folks. So the only thing I can say is I hope that you look at that we got to save our good productive farmland, and we have to have some encouragement to build the houses closer to town, not on good land. So I rallying on there a lot. I didn't know I was going to testify, but I talked to Ron the other day.
You did a wonderful job. We do have some questions. Representative Hansen.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, and good morning, John. I want the committee to know that John has worked on these issues for a long time. He was on the Met Council, and I know we've talked about them a lot. And your neighbors, you know, where the good crops were growing, you're seeing new houses growing, right? I mean, in Southern Dakota County, you're having houses are the new crop. And I know over your lifetime and some of the other folks who work with you, you see those changes and that people don't necessarily want to sell. But when it gets divided and you see a new big house go up and then perhaps they put a horse in the backyard and that's their commitment to agriculture. So I just maybe if you could indicate how you see that rate of sprawl occurring both from the south, from the east, from the west, and from the north. That'd be maybe helpful to the committee.
Mr. Kazemius.
Thank you. Well, there's the 7 acres just a half a mile from me sold for $100,000. And a person came out and built about a $300,000 house on it. And he works in St. Paul. And yet, if I could have bought that, I mean, we could have put an irrigator on there, and we could have been producing these peas on the land, but now we can't do that. And so, you know, we should extend the commitment. We should have it, maybe instead of having 8 years, we should put a 30-year commitment on there, or longer commitment, because they had a federal program that we could get money from the federal government, but they're out of money now, so they won't have that anymore. But at one time, we could have got more commitment, because farmers don't want to sell for houses, but there's three reasons why there's houses get built out there, and I've seen it many times. Is once, if a farmer has a tough time financially, and he has a little acreage off the side, he'll sell it for a developer house. That's one reason. The next reason is if a farmer suddenly ups and dies, and it goes to his estate, and there's one or the, say the boy or the son wants to farm, he has to buy out his other family members, and so they appraise the land. Well, you got three or four building sites, that just jacks the price up. So then he has to pay so much for it, and so then that's how the houses get out there, because he has to try and get his principal payments down. The third reason is, if a farmer is all set up and he gets a divorce, there again the house goes up for appraisal and the land is appraised, and so houses get built on that land. So if we have a longer commitment, maybe we can get over that hump of just so they get a divorce, they have to wait 30 years before they can sell it for development. I don't know.
Thank you. Representative Anderson, Bruce.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Well, Mr. Kazemias, I think you've got a good idea there in extending instead of 8 years to go longer. But as far as going to the federal government, they got lots of money. we see all the stimulus packages coming out. We could go for another one.
Was that a question, Representative Anderson?
Just a comment.
All right. Thank you, sir. So no other questions? Right. Thank you, Mr. Kazemias,
you
for your
much.
Testimony. Mr. Ronald Lindquist, come up and testify. And, sir, next we'll have Mr. is it Max Malmquist would be the next person up after this testifier. Please state your name for the record and begin.
Good morning. My name is Ron Lindquist. I'm from North Branch, Minnesota.
Yes, sir.
And the reason I got involved in this, I'm also on the city council in North Branch, and this got started. We have a family in our city. They are clear cutting 200 acres of evergreens and oaks for the sheer purpose that their taxes are too high, so they're going to clear cut it. They're almost done. They're going to remove all the stumps, and then they're going to go back to agriculture and farm it. For the sheer impact of the Green Acres Law and how it's impacted on taxes. So,
and Mr. Lindquist, how many acres was that? They're clear.
200 plus. I don't know exactly, but I know it's over 200.
Okay. Thank you, sir.
And our family has two 80-acre farms. One is in North Branch, and one is in the city of Harris. And in the city of Harris, we're approaching almost a century farm. It's been in our family that long, from my great grandparents. In all that time, it's always paid for itself, except for the last 2 years. The last 2 years, since the Green Acres Law has been changed, our taxes have gone up fourfold, and we rent it out. And it's about 50, it's almost 50-50, 37-43 on the tillable, non-tillable. For the first time in the history of our farm, we don't get enough on the rent to pay the taxes. That's never happened before. And I'm not the only one in this situation. If you have more tillable than non-tillable, sure, you're going to be okay. If you don't, we're hurting. And along with that, I've talked to Senator Alcine, former Senator Alcine, a number of times, and he says, Ron, what do I have to do? I said, for the Green Acres, and he says, Ron, he says, what you have to do on the non-tillable, he says, fence it in. Fence it in, make pasture out of it. He said, buy some cattle in the spring, or sheep, or goats, not horses, they don't count. He said, fence it in, you can sell them in the fall. He says, just show that you made some money on your cattle, and that counts. So I told Rick, I said, at my age, I'm in my mid-60s, you want me to go out there and fence it, and buy cattle, raise cattle, sell cattle, and all along with it, you got to buy insurance for them. You got to water them. Our house, our property, and our 80 acres in Harris is bare. It's nothing. There's not even electrical on it. So somewhere I'd have to get water for them. But that's the only way I could. That's the only way I would qualify for Green Acres. And I said, Rick, I said, this is an injustice. I said this is not the intent. He said, that's all we can do. So I got involved, and. After this property came up with their clear cutting, as I talked before, I went to every city in Chisauga County, all 10 cities, and I think there's only a couple that haven't passed a resolution. They've tabled them. They're going to act on them. As far as I know, all the rest have passed them. I talked to all 9 townships. They had one township meeting. They passed the resolution that night. So as far as I know, as of right now, there's only one city in the entire, or one unit of government in the entire county of Chisago that has not passed a resolution to reform the Green Acres Bill back to what it was previously. It is impacting our county tremendously. There is a vast number of landowners, and when I say my age group or older, I'm in my 60s. There's a lot of us at this age group that is really affecting us, and they're on fixed incomes, and their taxes are going up atrociously. Our land value on our farm in North Branch, like the lady said before, it went up. Now it's half of what it was. We have dropped it exactly in half from 3 years ago. That's our taxes haven't gone down, but our value's gone down in half. And a couple other things I would just, I'm not sure what you're going to do on the Rural Reserve Program, but one of the things of the Rural Reserve Program is you can't use the land for anything. My best friend lives in the city of Harris, and he has, I don't know how many cattle, but he was renting 85 or 90 acres of pasture land from his neighbor. The lady and her sons, they put that farm in the Rural Reserve Program. Hence, he can't pasture his cattle. So now he's got to take land out of production of that farm ground that he was producing to pasture his cattle or sell the cattle. If you would allow the Rural Reserve Program at least to be able to use for pasture, the cattle will keep the brush down and everything else that it keeps noxious weeds down. The cattle being pastured on that kind of land, on woodland or whatever, does not impact anything negatively as far as use of land. If you're not farming it, you are just you're actually controlling it with the use of the cattle. They will take care of this. That should be addressed. And I think that pretty much covers everything I have to say, and I really want to thank you for your time for letting me speak today.
Yes, sir, we do have a few questions, and your comment about a farm is a farm is a farm, we've heard that multiple times. You mentioned about some resolutions that have been passed. Different communities. If we can get copies of those too.
Our representative Bob Barrett has those.
All right. I was just informed that we do have copies.
You have those.
So thank you.
As I get some more, if they get passed, they will be going to Representative Barrett and also to Senator Sean Nino.
All right. Thank you so much. A couple questions here. Representative Paul Anderson.
Thanks, Mr. Chair. I don't think anybody in this room wants to see or hear about trees being cut down to become eligible for a program. But just a clarification, Mr. Malmquist, that 200-acre piece of ground you were talking about that's currently in the process of being clear-cut, was that in Green Acres prior to 2008?
Yes.
Mr. Lindquist.
As far as I know, yes. Mm-hmm. That 200 acres is a part of hundreds of acres. So I'm sure it was because it would be at that time you get the income off of all of it, and I'm sure it was, yes.
Representative Eakin.
Thank you, Mr. Chair and Mr. Lindquist. I was curious about, and I think you make some good points as far as the use of the land and allowing for flexibility there, and I was wondering about the clawback though, and you hadn't addressed that. Extending the clawback, if that would be something that you think would be acceptable, still allowing all those lands to be in the Green Acres, but making it more difficult for people to sell them for development purposes by requiring a longer, clawback for paying back taxes. I just wanted to know what your thoughts were on that.
Mr. Lindquist?
I think if it worked well in the past, at least in our area, as now there's nothing. There's nothing being developed. But in times past, we had a tremendous surge in the late 90s and early 2000s in North Branch. It grows from your hubs out. It isn't what you'd call sporadic. I've been involved in city governments for the last 30 years off and on, and I think the way the process is working was in our case in Chautauqua County, I think it worked just fine. Something comes in and you want to develop, so a developer comes in and he wants to buy 80 or 100 acres or whatever, and they develop with that. I think that works just fine. And then if you had if the landowner had Green Acres and they have to pay it back, and most of them realize that. If most landowners, if they're not adjacent to another building site, they're not affected by that. They'll stay in the Green Acres thing because the developer goes from one to the other to the other. That's what, I think it works just fine. They're kind of leaving it alone.
Representative Eakin. Okay. Seeing no other questions, I thank you for your testimony.
Thank you all very much.
Thank you, sir. Mr. Malmquist, and then we'll have Mr. George McMahon. So, Mr. Malmquist, are you here to testify? See him making his way. I didn't pick you up right away. You're in camouflage.
Yeah. I'm not a hunter.
Yeah. I'm just teasing. I find comfort in humor, so I mean this, no disrespect. So please state your name for the record and begin, please.
My name is Max Malmquist. I'm from North Branch. I was a city councilman, but it was 40 years ago, so I guess it doesn't count. At the current time, I own about 396 acres in North Branch, Sunrise, and Harris areas. I have owned up to probably 700 acres. I've got a handout that Representative Barrett put in your packets, and I don't want to read this in great detail, but it kind of summarizes the experiences that I've had since 2008. I've spent at least 200 hours talking to representatives, senators, going to meetings, meeting with the assessor, meeting with the DNR, going over options for my property. Very, very frustrating experience, to say the least. Let me kind of summarize some of the ideas that I've incorporated in this handout. I really believe that since I've been in the program, seems like since it started with parts of my land, but I always thought that it was a farm preservation, farmer preservation on marginal lands in the transitional forest areas that run from the southeast of the state up to towards the northwest, that do not have the high production values as you find on farmland down in the southwest. And I think to that extent it has worked pretty well in Chisago County up until the last decade and a half when we were farming houses, of course. But I think you need to focus not on what is a farm, but the perhaps not statutes, that the fact that this is a marginal farm preserve type program to sustain the farmers, to sustain the land. All land will get developed. Some of the pilgrims step foot on this country, they've had farmland outside their villages. Ultimately, all the land will get, or a great deal of it, will be developed one way or another. That's not bad, that's a good thing, and as our population has now exceeded 311 million people, it'll go on and on. But yet, the land around those areas, if it's preserved for a few years, or for 10 years, or for 20 years, it achieves the goal. There are many societal values of the non-acreage, I should say the non-tillable acreage. I believe it was a flawed idea for you to separate the tillable land from the woodlands, the wetlands, and the grasslands. And the wetlands recycle nutrients, they filter water that seeps down into the underground aquifers. All three of those habitats provide retention of native species in the area. And if you've read a recent issue of the Minnesota Conservation Volunteer, pollinating insects. There's about 120 pollinating bees in our state, 500 in Wisconsin, Michigan, and Minnesota altogether. A third of our food crops are pollinated by these bees. Well, what do they raise? They don't raise on tillable ground. Their homes are the woodlands, the grasslands, the native grasslands, the wetlands, depending on the species. Over half of the wildlife that's harvested in the state is raised on private lands. Considerable societal values. My neighbors don't want me to cut down my oak-diseased woods because of the view. The habitats provide native species of all kinds of songbirds that people feed and enjoy watching, as well as many other mammals. So there are considerable societal values, and I really feel it's a mistake to exclude those and not consider them as part of the farm. I have a number of other things I've listed. I don't want to go into all of that in detail. All laws are flawed. You certainly know that. And you can't get rid of all of the flaws. I guess as I mentioned, most land around metro or around cities will get developed sooner or later, and has since the country was founded. I might give you my experience with what I'm trying to do with my land and I don't know what I'm going to do with the non-tillable acres. I'm really, really confused. Like I said, I've spent over 200 hours. I've spent 3 days meeting with the county assessor in Chisholm County. The county assessor went through my 12 parcels, tax parcels. He separated out the non-tillable land down to a tenth of an acre. Altogether, we spent 3 days on this. He then tried to estimate what my property taxes would be with or without rural preserve. And I really don't know why what the revenue advantage is. If I go with rural preserve or if I go with forest management, the taxes will be about the same as with the green acres. So I don't see what's the purpose of going from one to the other. With the rural preserve law, you have to have a conservation plan written up. Who's going to do that? Well, the Craig Mell in Chisholm County, the head of the Soil and Water Office, county office, is going to write the plan. That's $200 plus a dollar per tillable acre. Conservation quote sounds nice, but what kind of conservation is it? It's a soil erosion conservation plan that he's going to write up. Soil erosion problems on my woodlands, on my wetlands, on my grasslands. I mean, that doesn't seem to be a problem there as compared to the tillable land. Also, the Soil and Water Office manages oak wilt, Dutch elm disease, ash borer that's going to be coming, exotic species, spotted knapweed, European buckthorn, Siberian elm, which has taken over the northern pin oak forests in the area and all throughout Carlos Avery. I have hundreds of northern pin oaks dying every year on my properties of oak wilt disease. If he decides to put in my conservation plan that I have to deal with all those diseases and tree species, exotic tree species, there isn't enough money in Minnesota to deal with that in rural lands. I don't have any control. That's up. Suddenly, the government is gaining control of my property if I sign up for these programs, yet my land then is tied up for 8 years or more. I have to apply 5 years in advance if I want to get out of it. It seems to me that there isn't a significant tax revenue by the solutions that you passed for rural preserve or forest management. I have a friend that decided to go with forest management. He paid a fellow $280. The fellow wrote up the forest management plan, didn't even come to his property, filed it with the DNR. He says, I know what's on your property. I'm not going to worry about it. So he satisfied what he needed to do. I don't know what I'm going to do. I've researched this. I'm extremely confused. The whole thing doesn't make a lot of sense to me. I guess in my recommendations, I would say I believe that you need to go back to repeal the changes that were made, but that's going to be very difficult because, as Ron mentioned, in North Branch, right around me, and this is not documented anywhere, but I've seen hundreds and hundreds of acres. I've seen fallow fields that have been plowed up in the last year or two, put into crops. I've seen windrows that have been cut down. In 1914, Chisago County, by 1914, Chisago County and Isani County were almost barren of trees. They had been cleared by the early settlers. Dust storms were extremely common. And the conservation movement led to the planting of windrows. You still see them along the highways and so on. And now a lot of that's being cut down so people can finagle some way to stay under the Green Acres program, as he mentioned. And there are large tracts, small tracts happening all over that nobody is really aware of or can keep track of because there's no way of monitoring how much land has been changed since 2008. So I'd like to thank everybody. And in my handout, I think Bob Barrett said it included Representative Barrett in the
yes, Mr. Malmquist, we do have your notes here in our binders as well, members. Are there any questions for the testifier? No? Representative Hansen.
Mr. Chair, in the converted land that was converted from woodland or wetland to crops, is that now growing corn and soybeans?
Mr. Malmquist.
Yes. And I think about, what, nationwide 40% is going for ethanol right now, it's estimated.
Mr. Chair, you know, I think commodity prices have skyrocketed since 2008, and there may be other factors besides green acres in terms of conversion of farmland, in terms of what's happening, in terms of why people are planting stuff.
Thank you, Representative Hansen. Representative Morrow?
Thank you, Mr. Chair. And I'd like to thank Mr. Malmquist, though, for also reminding us of the other benefits of some of the lands, including the wetlands that you described. Yes, some of them may have been turned into farmland, or the wood acres may have been turned into farmland.
Or pasture.
But you also note some of the other benefits. I know, Mr. Chair, that we're trying to figure out how not only to preserve but to expand wetlands as we talk about upcoming floods, and we talk about water management. I do hope, Mr. Chair, at some point we'll talk about all the different programs the state has designed to preserve and expand our wetlands in Minnesota, because Green Acres wasn't intended to be a wetland preserve. It was pretended to, I think, as Representative Hansen mentioned, to deal with some significant tax inequalities. Mr. Chair, finally, I would suggest, I know we have a working group tomorrow, that we also look at the definition of farming, and maybe this committee needs to include the definition or the purpose, the policy statement under that definition within the Green Acres definition. We could talk about that tomorrow as well.
Thank you, Representative Morrow. Any other questions for the testifier? Malmquist?
I think the definition, too, of a farmer is a little bit hard to pin down. Most of the farmers that I know in Chisago and Isani County that make a good living are farming 1,000 to 3,000 acres. You have all kinds of people on smaller tracts of land that certainly couldn't be making anywhere close to a living. My taxes went up about 180% on my rural land last year, mostly due to the elimination of the unlimited market value. If I don't go with rural preserve, the assessors estimated my taxes could double or possibly triple on that property, and I might be looking at 12 to 14,000 on land where I'm getting 2,000 of annual income. So that's a big factor as to whether I can keep it.
So, yes, sir.
Thank you.
Thank you, Mr. Malmquist, for your testimony. We'd like to call up Mr. George McMahon, please. And after Mr. McMahon's testimony, I believe we have an individual from Houston County that would like to testify on behalf of the assessors. So we'll ask that testifier to come up next. So please state your name for the record. And
Mr. Chairman, begin. George McMahon, Chisago County Vice Chair. I also have with me Chisago County Commissioner Ben Mosca. And
welcome.
Thank you for the time you're going to give us. We're trying to fill in for our assessor who was going to be here this morning, but sorry he can't make it. So I'm going to talk a little bit about the amount of time it takes in our assessor's office to try to determine what is farm and what isn't farm. And we have, as you all know, we have had shortages in our revenue that's coming into the county, and we've adjusted our whole county staff to try to adjust and keep our revenue down from the county and keep a zero increase in our taxes. So one of the things that we've been watching is the amount of time it takes for the assessor to sit with people and go out and look at pieces of land. And if you will, we almost have to police what's happening. If the person comes in and says this is pasture or not pasture, then how do we determine that next year if something changes? So I'm here to support House File 12, I guess it is, which would say the Green Acres return to the pre-2008 status. And I'm looking at it more, and also Commissioner Mosca and I are on the budget committee of our county, And again, we're looking at the time. We had to hire a full-time person and another half-time person just to try to determine this green acres, what it qualifies ag land or not ag land. So with that, if you'd like to say something, Commissioner, and Commissioner Mosca I represent basically cities in our county. Commissioner Mosca has a combination of agriculture and residential properties, so he'd like to say a few words, if you could, Mr. Chairman.
Thank you. Commissioner Moss.
Thank you so much, Mr. Chair. In our county, we have our county board. I should also note that our county board has passed a resolution, several resolutions, requesting that the state legislature consider going back to the pre-2008 language. And we're concerned about the eligibility requirements. I've looked at the provisions in the proposed statutes. I don't have a sense, I don't have official action from our board as to our positions on the specific provisions here. It looks like these are good changes that would be helpful. I just want to make sure that in Subdivision 6, which I didn't have Westlaw, so I couldn't look it up, make sure that is the pre or is the eligibility requirements that our county has used as a primary source, primary means to protect open space and the farming in our county. In our county, we have a number of property owners that have large tracts of land, yet are partnering with farmers. And under the current, and by doing so, they're preserving the important open space that is a significant part of our county. Our county is a very beautiful county. We have and we have a real need to protect the environment, and that is in our opinion, a primary program that our county has used historically. In our county, also, the ag business employs a number of people, many hundreds of people in our county, and we certainly want to support that. So that's what I have to say, and I just thank you so much for re-looking at this issue, and we appreciate the attempts by the legislature in the last several years to make some adjustments to the far-reaching changes that I think were made in 2008, if my recollection is correct. I think some of those were in the right direction. However, our board is continuing to request respectfully that the legislature consider going back to the provisions in effect in 2008.
So thank you. Any questions for the testifiers? Well, I thank you for your time, gentlemen.
Thank you.
Appreciate that. All right. Thank you. Next, if we could bring up the members from Houston County to, yes, would you like to come up and testify on behalf of, well, state your name for the record and who you represent, please.
Mr. Chairman, members, my name again is John Hagan. I'm the Director of the Private Tax Division with the Minnesota Department of Revenue, and we're working closely with the assessors and MAO that's represented by Mr. Dibbing from Houston County, and they asked that I go first, precede Mr. Dibbing's comments, so that's satisfactory to the committee.
Yes, please proceed.
It's an interesting testimony today. I was particularly impressed with Mr. Malmquist's testimony at the end and Mr. Konzemius's. There's a lot of factors that play and a lot of things that we're all very interested in maintaining the quality of life in Minnesota and farmland in Minnesota. Mr. Malmquist mentioned that he thought Green Acres was working well in Chisago County, as did some of the other testifiers, and I think it probably was. I think Green Acres did work well in parts of the state, particularly at Central Bend, maybe in through Chisago and Isanti, and some of those sort of third-ring counties out of the metro that where the land was starting to develop. I think it worked quite well. The problem that was encountered, I think, as tax administrators is that the state is so large and so diverse, and things that worked well in one part of the county that are specific to specific property, use of the property, don't necessarily work well in other parts of the county. We've experienced that a great deal in our work in Green Acres with trying to apply Green Acres to the southeastern part of the state where you've got the terrain of the bluffs and the cliffs and all the land that's being farmed can be farmed. Southwestern part of the state is almost all farmland, so a lot of these things don't even apply there. The areas in Chisago and Isanti where the bulk of it is farmed, where there's things like windrows separating. And just for the record, I should point out, too, that one of the biggest problems you face as legislators and the and assessors like Mr. Dibbing face as tax administrators as well as the department is there's so much misinformation and misunderstanding out there on what is and is not happening from the Green Acres. Nobody was ever required to cut down windrows. That would be included as impractical to separate and would always qualify for Green Acres, and likely, as Mr. Representative Hansen alluded to, that was an economic decision, not a decision based on Green Acres. Let me real briefly go through this. I know you're short of time, but I'd like to explain a little bit about sort of the radical statement I start off with is none of the tax horror stories you're hearing, the 1,000, 2,000, 3,000% increases in taxes, were the result of changes in Green Acres. In fact, I would submit to you that none of the changes in taxes that you're hearing were the result of Green Acres. There would have been some changes out a few years when the rural preserve lands, when the property owners had to make a determination on that, but that hadn't come into play yet. That comes into play in 2012. The only way that you might be able to reasonably and honestly link Green Acres changes to the changes, the horrifying tax increases that some of these property owners have explained, have experienced, is in an instance where a property was not being farmed and didn't qualify for the ag classification. The assessors, by virtue of the fact that they were required to go out and look and identify the 2A tillable lands and the 2B none, the 2B rural vacant lands, oftentimes in the course of that experience, identified lands that were not being farmed, that hadn't been farmed for years. And in some cases, a farmer had retired from farming, and most of these were smaller farms. People that maybe farmed as a hobby, and they planted into trees, or they just let it go back to brush, whatever. And it hadn't been farmed for years and years and years. The assessors identified this going through the 2A, 2B exercise. And one other last piece of testimony I'd like to link to, too, is the representative from Chisago County saying the cost to the county of identifying the difference between 2A and 2B. And I realize and recognize that was an expense in some counties. I would also, from my perspective as a tax administrator with the Department of Revenue and a former county assessor for that matter, I would argue that assessors always should have had an understanding of what lands are tillable, what lands are woods, because for the simple fact an ad valorem tax is based on value, what the property would sell for. And I would submit that swampland sells differently than woodland sells differently than tillable lands. In the last 2 or 3 years, tillable lands have increased dramatically in value, while a lot of other types of values, properties, the woodlands and the swamp in particular, the recreational development ones, have decreased in price. It is imperative for the assessor, and always has been, to be able to differentiate between the 2A and 2B. We call them productive or non-productive in the old days, when I started, which is old days, I guess. But that's always been an expectation. Some jurisdictions got, for whatever reason, they got a little lax on enforcement, or for staffing reasons, or whatever reason, they didn't do a particularly good job. Excuse me, of monitoring those changes. And those very changes were the ones that led to the horror stories you've heard on the Green Acres, where people hadn't been farming. I knew of one county where they not only did not, as required by law, classify the property based on the use. They would look at a property, and the instance they gave me was a 40-acre wooded piece of property where they built a structure on it, and they lived on a 40-acre piece of property, all woods. Nobody in this room would say that's a farm, but the assessor in this instance looked not at the use of the property, but looked at other properties in that jurisdiction or in that surrounding area and said, well, these are farmers, he should be a farm. Consequently, once he was into the farm class, he got Green Acres. Another issue that was bouncing around a little earlier was, what does it really take to become agricultural? And one of the reasons it was so problematic statewide with the Green Acres, and when it was really exacerbated, was all the value increases in the post 9/11 era, when people were taking their money out of the banks the stock market, because it wasn't performing very well, and there was a real movement towards buying recreational lands and. As it was a better investment, people were also taking a lot of the equity in their houses out and getting a second mortgage on their house and buying recreational land. So we had this huge push on the value of recreational lands, which was causing all the woodlands to be worth more. It's hard to believe, it wasn't that many years ago, to be in most instances worth more than the tillable lands. Hence, they would qualify for Green Acres. To get in the door on Green Acres, all you really had to do is have 10 acres or more in production, 10 acres or more tillable or in pasture. Once you had that, you could get 600, 800, 1,000 acres of the rural vacant land into the Green Acres program as well. So the real horror stories, the 2-3,000% store increase stories, were the ones where the assessor had them misclassified, and I think all assessors would agree to that. And I should at some point too make mention that assessors as a whole do an outstanding job of implementing the laws as you pass them. There's a few that haven't maybe been as good, and those are the ones that kind of generate the horror stories. And some who are inherited bad practices and just continued them and didn't make the change. The second reason for tax increases were, as some of the testifiers talked about, were more in the neighborhood of 30, 50, 100% increases. And that is kind of the result of what we attributed to be a perfect storm. You had, as Mr. Malmquist correctly identified, the elimination of limit to market value caused property taxes to go up. The farmlands were increasing in value. The only thing in the state that was increasing in value in the past 2 or 3 years was farmlands. While all the residential commercial properties on Main Street were going down in value, consequently, as they assumed a larger role of the taxable value, their taxes increased. They assumed a greater percentage of the taxes. What was the third issue? Oh, the tier break, which is it's kind of a just for pointing ahead to tax administrators like myself, but it's a huge difference where farm properties get a class rate of 0.50 on the first $1,010,000 in market value. I think last year it was up to $1,140,000. It's indexed to follow the rate of inflation. But once they go off that 0.50 class rate, they would jump into the 1% class rate, which would cause a doubling of their property taxes for no other reason except as a property in the chain increased in value, the ones on the end of the chain would double, even though their value wouldn't have necessarily changed. Their value would have actually doubled.
Mr. Hagan, we do have a few more testifiers as well.
What I'd like you to say is, in closing, I would be very happy to work with the committee. We're already working with the assessors, trying to figure out some reasonable ground in areas that we can work with to the satisfaction of this committee and the citizens of the state of Minnesota. I believe the Green Acres, for the most part, is in pretty good shape. The Green Acres laws, as they were passed in 2008 and more importantly amended in 2009, are in pretty good shape at the present. Rural Preserve needs some work. I think that we all agreed that the Rural Preserve could use some work. Maybe there's some changes could be made to the covenant, even as much as the elimination. Use some of it, get rid of the conservation, some of the other requirements in the property that might make it more acceptable and make it in a position where assessors could evenly and equitably administer the laws.
Thank you, sir. You have anything to add?
Yeah. My name is Tom Dipping. I'm the Houston County Assessor.
Welcome.
I'm also a member of the MAAO Legislative Committee. And on behalf of the committee, I'd just like to say that the law changes that occurred going from differentiating between 2A and 2B has improved our assessment system, and I believe that we have a better equality out there just because of the fact it required us to go and look at those types of things. I guess from what I've found in our county, we got out of 800 ag homesteads, we got 681 of them that are signed up, and it's all about the woods down in our area, Houston County, Winona County, and Fillmore County. We instituted the Green Acres Law in 2000, and it had worked quite well up until the 2008 changes. The thing, the pushback from our county is basically on the covenant. The property owners that decided to get out was all about the covenant. They didn't like the idea of committing their land for that amount of time. We have seen in the assessment plan, we have seen some different implementations throughout the different counties. We've had full-blown forest management plans to basically a generic plan that is handed out and costs $50, or the forest management plan that can go upwards into $400. And also with the covenant, there's some issues with recording the property with the recorders. We want to make sure that the covenant is on the abstract of the property, the owner of the property, and maybe not on some adjoining properties. So the legal description is very imperative when they present that to the recorder's office. And just one thing to keep in mind to the committee, we have a May 1st deadline for the first entry into the Rural Preserve. And I certainly don't want to rush to judgment to change things, but if you repeal the law, if you got people that have already filed covenants and got plans, there's some issues that are going to be out there based on the fact that you have this first May 1st deadline coming up.
So do we have any questions? You've been very helpful as well, and I know you've been very involved in this. I've heard from you, and I believe we know how to get a hold of you as well. If we have any additional, you're still.
I'll certainly be available.
Thank you, sir. Sure. Yeah, appreciate that. Oh, excuse me, Representative Szymanski.
Mr. Chairman, not for the testifier, okay. But is it Mr. Hagan from the Revenue Department?
If
he will come back to another meeting, I would have further questions for him. I don't want to get into it today.
He's nodding his head yes.
All right.
So, very good. Thank you. Sir Rob Eastland, former representative, if you'd like to come up, please. So, welcome back, my friend. State your name for the record, please, and please proceed. And then we'd like to hear from Farmers Union and Farm Bureau, too. And just so everybody knows, technically we have about 7 minutes left, but know how this place works, my friend.
I'll try to be quick. I'm Rob Eastland from Isani, Minnesota, former representative. I was one of the House members that carried the bill last year to repeal and the year before to repeal that did not. So I support the concept of a repeal, but I think I'm here today as a private citizen owning 200 acres in Green Acres, seeing my neighbors and myself struggle with how to address the new law. And it has had a huge impact, as many people have said. I won't repeat those things. But I just want to come with a kind of a five-step plan that I think are issues that need to be addressed in anything that happens in Green Acres if we're going to improve what's going on. The first thing, it's been mentioned before, a farm is a farm. When people came to this country and homesteaded their farm, they homesteaded their farm. They didn't homestead 2A and 2B. And that's what they have. I live on a century farm. It's been in our family for 130 some years or whatever it is, and we want to keep it in our farm. And if taxing is going to become the issue that's going to make it whether or not we can hold on to it. Because right now the rent that I get, I farm some of it, but the rent that I get barely pays for the taxes. And I think that's a shame when people are holding onto their farm, especially when people get more elderly, 60s, 70s, 80 years old, and they're sitting on a homestead, and now they're faced with an idea of having to go into two different programs, not understanding what to do. Their farm is their retirement. It's their whole fortune. It's everything they have, and we have messed with that as a legislature, and it has created a lot of consternation out in the common folks in our communities. But first of all, a farm should be a farm. So 2A and 2B land should both be able to be in Green Acres, period. And I think you ought to be able to go back to 2008, and whatever you were in 2008 ought to be grandfathered in. I mean, that I think is a fair way to start. A farm is a farm. 2A and 2B land can be in there. You go back to your position in 2008. If you qualify under whatever the rules are, you stay in. So that's the first two. The farm is a farm, and your grandfather. And the third thing is, I think the Rural Preserve Program has some value because we live in a different world today than we did in 1967. Green space is an important commodity around our state, and I think the whole idea of the Rural Preserve is a great option for people who don't farm, but own large quantities of land. 2A and 2B land could be in the Rural Preserve. If somebody wants to own a chunk of land and not farm it, but they're willing to sign up for a covenant and let it be in there for 10 years or 8 years or whatever the covenant is, and leave it as green space, that benefits everybody in our society. And I hear more than anything in my community, which is a very high growth community in the last 6-7 years, that we need to do something to stop the sprawl. And that would give some tools to people to be able to own land, higher acreages of land, and keep them out of the development stream. So that's the third thing. The fourth thing that I think is important and imperative that we change is this five-county assessment process is an absolute joke, regardless of what the Department of Revenue says. I appreciate their effort in putting it together, but you cannot make a formula that crosses every geographic area of our state, all the different landscapes, whether it's farm, whether it's marginal farmland, southwest Minnesota. You can't make a formula that works. You might have a drought in northern Minnesota where they have marginal farmland. They don't get any crops, and you have a bumper crop in southwestern Minnesota, and we see a 25% increase in ag land. That's going to ricochet right back up to an area of the state where they should see a decline in ag land. The value of ag land should be determined by the county assessor and by local county boards. We pay local property tax in this state. That's how it's defined, local property tax. They ought to be able to make those decisions. And that gets me to the fifth thing. I think counties ought to be able to decide if they want to be in these programs. A county ought to be able to decide if they want to administer Green Acres or administer a conservation program. It should be a county decision. We can have regulations as far as the state is concerned about how you have to run it, and if you're going to run it, you meet these standards, but counties ought to be able to make that decision, because there's places where Green Acres doesn't make sense. There's places where it makes sense. There's places where Conservation Reserve makes a lot of sense, where Green Acres doesn't make. So we have all kinds of mixes. Let the local jurisdictions decide that. Give them a platform and a clear enough understanding of how they can use these programs. And they can manage their communities, and they can keep their whole communities alive and healthy. And I think that's what we're about, is trying to keep the state of Minnesota healthy, and we do that when we keep our local, small, local units of governments in control of what they do and let them make the decisions to keep their own communities healthy. So that's my comment, my quick fix. Thank you.
If you have any questions, testify. Thank you so much for your testimony. If we can have members from Farm Bureau and Farmers Union come up, and I'll let you flip a corn, and see, no pun intended, right? See who would like to go first. So
thank you, Mr. Chairman. Beauty, yes, before age. My name's Chris Raditz. I'm Director of Public Policy for Minnesota Farm Bureau. I think it's been a very informative and useful hearing. I've changed my comments about 100 times, but I'm going to keep it real short. Actually, I think former Representative Eastland really set the stage for tomorrow. I think he identified in his five steps the issues that really should be looked at as you're looking at a legislation. And I think we had hearings in ag committees on Green Acres before. And the intent of the Ag Committee was a farm is a farm. And we thought we had that covered. I don't have the exact statute language with me, but there is a piece in there about being impracticable to separate. And in our view, if you had a farm and it had a ravine running through it, or a slough or a woodlands, that you weren't going to really sell it separately to anybody, then that should be in the farm and stay at 2A and stay in Green Acres. And I would also agree that as we worked on Green Acres changes, we were constantly asking, is this going to impact farmers, ag land? And the answer was no. And that's really correct. If you had tillable land pre-2008 and it's still tillable land, it really didn't impact you. It's the whole rural preserve issue. We'd really encourage you to take a look at that rural preserve program. And in your packet, there was a letter from a Glenn Holmstrom, who's a Farm Bureau member from Chisago County. And I think that's the dilemma. He laid it out really well. He's got this 300-acre piece of property. 16 acres are woodlands adjoining a lake. And his option is to go into the rural preserve, but he doesn't want the covenant. He doesn't want the management plan. And Mr. Hagan is right. Nothing in Green Acres requires you to plow up trees or wood... windrows or anything like that. However, you have to plow them up so you can farm it to qualify for Green Acres, so it does kind of work hand in hand. So we'll be happy to work with the committee. I guess my final point would be, as you look at legislation, I think it's important to, if you develop a piece of legislation, pull the stakeholders together, revenue, farm groups, landowners, and assessors, and say, okay, if we pass this legislation, revenue, what's the guidance document going to look like? County assessors, how are you going to implement it on the ground? Because I think we had some anticipation of legislation and how it would work, but as it got out through the various channels, it didn't quite wasn't quite implemented how we thought it would work. So if we can avoid that, that would be helpful.
That's great advice. Thank you. Mr. Peterson.
Mr. Chairman, members of the committee, my name is Tom Peterson. I represent the Minnesota Farmers Union, and I would pretty much just echo everything Mr. Raditz said. Our members have been frustrated with the changes. The concept is, you know, that we hear is a farm is a farm. And I would echo again, this is a really important point, as the impractical to split, that this letter from, you know, Mr. Holmstrom, it does really say
And this is where a lot of our members have heartburn. He has 300 acres, and he's got to cut out 16 acres. You know, that when we talked about this bill 2 years ago and we made the changes, that 16 acres, you know, I think that was our understanding, that that would have been impractical to split. But somehow, how it got from revenue to the assessors to the farmer, he's having to look at that. And I think that that is a lot of the heartburn there. And so, and that, you know, comes down to the preserve program is another one of our concerns. We would support removing the conservation plan or simplifying it greatly. You know, you hear it's anywhere from $100, $50 to $500. The plans vary quite a bit. There's a lot of confusion about that. And then also the covenant is a issue. We support just making it 3 years. And making it across the board at that. And I will, one other item I would encourage the committee to look at is, as Representative Hansen brought up earlier, and it wasn't in the statute to preserve farmland. That's one of the goals of the program. Or I would encourage the committee, and that's a position of Farmers Union, that one of the goals of Green Acres is to preserve farmland. So I'll leave it at that. Thank you.
Do we have any questions? The testifiers. Gentlemen, thank you so much for allowing others to go in front of you as well to testify. I know they traveled great distances as well. So, seeing no other questions, any other business? Look at those. All right. Next committee meeting. We're actually not going to have a committee meeting tomorrow. It's going to be the working group where we can come down here. We do have the room reserved, right? And so we're just going to meet down here and work on some of this, discuss what we just heard today. So, of course, you're all invited. And then we'll take up the three Green Acres bills on Thursday. All right? So with that, members, meeting is adjourned.